I'm going to be dealing with a topic that I think is an extremely important one. I think many of us have talked about for years about the benefits of intravenous iron, and the two previous speakers alluded to much of this. But there are many physicians that have concerns about the safety of intravenous iron, so I would like to address this topic in as objective a way as I possibly can. So I think if you were to discuss what the safety concerns with intravenous iron products in general are, you'd probably make a list of these five, and I'll cover each of these five in turn. So there are concerns with short-term adverse effects of intravenous iron in the either in the immediate post-injection period or shortly afterwards. In the long term, how much iron can we give is safe. We certainly don't want to induce iron overload like many of our dialysis patients had before the days of erythropoietin therapy. There are concerns about potential for intravenous iron to increase the risk of bacterial and other infections, increase oxidative stress, and then what about the impact of intravenous iron on mortality? So I'm going to deal with each of these. So we'll start with the short-term adverse events. So I think the first thing that many of us are concerned about and recognize is that there are reactions to intravenous iron. I think most of us have seen reactions to intravenous iron, and I'll come back to that. Then there's the issue of, is intravenous iron toxic to the kidney, particularly relevant in non-dialysis patients, obviously. Any effect on proteinuria? And finally, hypophosphatemia. So we'll just go through these. So we'll start with the reactions. Now, I have to say I've never seen an anaphylactic reaction to intravenous iron. I have some colleagues in the UK that have, and it obviously was very frightening. And these are the days of iron dextran preparations. And the patient was very sick. And in fact, there have been fatalities with intravenous iron dextran reported in the UK. Now, these are very severe reactions. To be clear, they're type 1 anaphylactic allergic reactions. They're mediated by immunoglobulin E. And there is a pathogenetic mechanism that's well described, which involves the release of histamine from basophils and mast cells. And of course, for the patient's point of view, there are profound vasoactive, hemodynamic, and respiratory effects. And clearly this needs to be, it's a life-threatening event. It requires immediate subcutaneous adrenaline, plus or minus steroids, plus or minus antihistamines. So that's an anaphylactic reaction. Of course, what I have seen, and I guess many of you have seen, is the anaphylactoid reactions, which are not IgE-mediated. They're not believed to contain an immunological basis at all, and yet I think many physicians still treat them as anaphylaxis with subcutaneous adrenaline or whatever. And we recognize that they are probably due to non-transferrin-bound iron or labile iron in the circulation. Now, iron should be bound by transferrin. That's the natural protein that binds iron in the body. If there's iron that's not bound to transferrin, then that potentially will cause the same kind of reactions as you see with the anaphylactic type reactions. They're still vasoactive, hemodynamic in terms of a lowering of blood pressure and acute respiratory distress in these patients. And they can be very frightening for the patient and for the attending physician. But there is a distinction between them. And we have to recognize that. And the anaphylaxis is mainly an iron dextran problem, and the anaphylactoid type of reactions are with every single intravenous iron described. Now, this has been looked at in pharmacovigilance studies. This is one slightly old study now from the FDA looking at adverse events occurring during a period of 2001 to 2003 per million doses of different intravenous iron preparations. And you can see that there are rates of 11.3 for the high molecular weight iron dextran, 3.3 for low molecular weight iron dextran, 0.9 for iron gluconate, and 0.6 for iron sucrose. And of course, the newer intravenous irons aren't in this pharmacovigilance database. Some of you may be interested that George Bailey's presenting an update on pharmacovigilance at the Sunday morning anemia-free communication session if you're interested in seeing some brand new data presented on adverse events with intravenous iron products. Nephrotoxicity. Now, there are certainly people in the world, Professors Agarwal and Zagar, that will present their data, and their very persuasive data in the laboratory and in the animal setting, that iron will cause acute hemodynamic effects on the glomerular circulation in animals. There's a dysfunction of the cubulin-megalin pathway. There's a demonstration of increased blood and urinary cytokines in animals, and indeed also in CKD patients. There's a recently described study as well that will come on to in the next slide. And this may mediate proteinuria, and it may worsen renal function. At least that's a hypothesis. I have to say all the clinical data does not support that, and we have a fair bit of clinical data now, but not enough. Ankel de Francisco described the renal function in the FAIR-HF study, Van Wyk study. There are many clinical randomized control studies that do not show that there's a concern with nephrotoxicity, but you could argue follow-up small. This is a study that Professor Agarwal published a few months ago, looking at the nephrotoxicity of iron and showing really that with two iron products, iron sucrose and iron gluconate, that there is a difference depending on whether the patient's on an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker. In fact, there was really no effect seen in patients that were on an ACE inhibitor or an ARB in terms of albuminuria. Well, there is a concern there, and I think it's something we have to gather more information about. Then I see that Professor Hogg-Tobley from Argentina is in the audience, and this is his data that he published last year in NDT in a rat model looking at various IV iron preparations in terms of pro-inflammatory markers. And this shows here the TNF-alpha and the interleukin-6 immunostaining, and you can see that there is a difference from one iron product to another. The control is in the brown on the right-hand side. You've got low and high molecular weight iron dextran in the pink and the white, and then you have the ferric carboxymaltose in the blue and the iron sucrose in the yellow. So you can see there are differences there between the iron preparations, the ferric carboxymaltose and the iron sucrose, showing a less degree of inflammatory stimulus. Now, there's a lot of interest in hypophosphatemia. The first description was in the literature in 1994 when a patient got quite marked hypophosphatemia following intravenous iron, and there's been several case reports since then. My own personal experience is that there are patients who will have a reduction in phosphate following intravenous iron. I don't think it's everybody, and I don't think it's a population effect. I think there are individuals that will develop reductions in phosphate following intravenous iron, and there's some suggestion that that's due to increased FGF23 levels. We can come back and discuss that at the end. But moving on rapidly to iron overload. So how much iron can we give to a patient, and how much is too much, and where does it actually go? So first of all, to deal with where it actually goes, if you radiolabel iron, as this study did, iron is taken up in the liver and the spleen and the bone marrow. So it's the reticuloendothelial system, basically. And obviously, where you expect it to end up is in the bone marrow, ultimately for red cell utilization. And in this study, which was conducted in iron-deficient subjects, there were six in this very small study, you can see there's very high percentage of red cell utilization, up to 61 to 99%. In these subjects, is the iron is actually getting into the red cell, which of course is not toxic. That's where the iron's supposed to be in the first place, suggesting that these patients were indeed iron deficient and needed iron to get into the red cell. Now, Carlo's already told you a bit about hepcidin, and we now recognize its very important role in regulating iron availability and controlling how much iron we absorb from our diet. Absorption from the duodenum is heavily regulated by hepcidin. If we have a defect in that, then we'd end up with profound iron overload, and that's the conditions, of course, of hereditary hemochromatosis, etc. So what other ways can we get iron overload? Well, obviously, we could flood our patients with intravenous iron over years, or we could give them multiple blood transfusions. So if you use a paradigm model here, thalassemia. So we don't look after many patients with thalassemia, but the hematologists do. And, of course, due to their genetic defect in the hemoglobin gene, the globin gene, they have they're heavily transfusion dependent. Many of these patients require up to 100 units of packed red cells over a 2 to 4 year period. And if you quantitate how much iron that is, that's over 20 grams of iron these patients are getting. Now, I don't think any of us would advocate that we should be giving 20 grams of intravenous iron to our patients. Some of us get concerned if we give 1 gram, but 20 grams over 3 years is a lot. That's how many patients, that's how much blood thalassemic patients get, and the normal body iron stores are about 3 or 4 grams. So what does that cause to the patient? Well, as the patient gets older, unfortunately, it causes hepatic toxicity. They end up with cirrhosis. They end up with cardiac dysrhythmias. They get endocrine abnormalities. They get heart failure, and they eventually die quite young. We certainly don't want to do that to our patients. But this is a very extreme case of iron overload, and I think we're well away from that in terms of how much iron we're suggesting our patients should be getting. So if we give too much, this is just an autopsy specimen from a thalassemic patient. You can see the iron staining in blue there at the top with a control liver below. And if you look at the histology of this, then of course with the Prussian blue stain, it stains very densely blue as an indicator of iron overload. Now, obviously, you can't do liver biopsies on our patients readily, and we have newer methods, but this is still quite cumbersome, the ability to quantitate iron in the liver by MRI scanning. And there are techniques that are available. This is the T2 star technique that MRI can give you in terms of quantitating quite accurately how much grams of iron is present in the liver. The problem with this is it's very labor-intensive, it's cumbersome, and it's obviously a very expensive investigation to do. So we tend to rely on laboratory markers. We have some listed here. These are the ones that we might use or not use. I don't think many of us probably use erythrocyte zinc protoporphyrin, but most of us use serum ferritin. And that is traditionally one of the ways that we stop iron being giving too much iron. So if we look at the ferritin levels, and this was summarized in this review by Kamyar Kalantarzadeh 2 years ago, and he looked at different serum ferritin ranges. He divided these into four groups, so less than 200, 200 to 500, 500 up to 1,200, and over 1,200. And he looked at that in terms of what that meant for the patient in terms of iron deficiency and the need for intravenous iron. It's a nice review. I'm not going to go through the details of it, but in a nutshell, if you've got a patient less than 200, there's almost certainly a case for strongly considering intravenous iron in this group. Between 200 and 500, many of these patients will have functional iron deficiency and will need intravenous iron as well. When you're in the 500 to 1200 range, indeed, there still may be patients with functional iron deficiency, as shown by the DRIVE study, particularly if their transferrin saturations are less than 25%, and they may benefit, but of course, there's a note of caution when you get up to these kind of ferritin levels. And above 1200, we certainly don't want to end up in the state of play of inducing the iron overload that our thalassemic patients get after 20 grams of iron. So above 1200, I think it's fair to say that the evidence for intravenous iron being safe is not there, and there should be an extreme note of caution at this kind of level. So increased risk of infection. This is another thing that is often discussed. Giving intravenous iron to our patients, does that mean we're going to induce more bacteremia and more types of infections? We recognize that in experimental iron administration to animals, we will impact on T cell function, on polymorphonuclear neutrophil migration, and on phagocytosis, the ability to phagocyte bacteria, and in getting rid of bacteria from the system. So there are clearly problems or potential problems in giving intravenous iron in terms of inducing a propensity to infection. And this is one of the studies. This came from Walter Hurl's group in Vienna, looking at neutrophil killing capacity. And you can see, compared to placebo in the blue and in the iron sucrose in the green, that after 120 and 180 minutes, there was a diminishing capacity for the E. coli to be killed off in this bacterial experiment in the laboratory. So it's clearly positive. Should we be concerned clinically about giving intravenous iron to our patients? Well, I'm going to show you just very briefly three observational studies, because that's the best of what we've got. This is the one from Tehan and colleagues, published in 2004. And you can see that for iron replete patients, there was statistically, but only at the 0.03 level, higher chance of bacteremia in these patients. So borderline, but nothing like the propensity for bacterial infection with a venous catheter use. And then you can look at the Bruno Hearn study from Paris, which is a nice prospective observational study of nearly 1,000 hemodialysis patients looking at risk factors for bacteremia and basically concluding that IV iron administration in any amount did not significantly impact on the risk of bacteremia in chronic hemodialysis patients. And again, in this study, dialysis catheters came out as the big thing that increased the risk of bacterial infection. And then this data was presented at the last ASN meeting in San Diego by George Bailey, and it's data from DOPS looking at, if you look at just the yellow bars there, which is the infection-related mortality, in terms of intravenous iron dosing per month, you can see that in terms of the reference range, which is 100 to 200 milligrams per month, after you get to 200 or 300 or 300 to 400 or even more than 400, it doesn't go up anymore. It actually comes down again. So there isn't a very firm relationship there between iron loading and the risk of infection in this DOPS analysis. And then we can move on to oxidative stress, and we have to recognize that iron in the laboratory setting, unquestionably, through the Fenton reaction, will increase oxidative stress. It will generate free hydroxyl radicals, and they will attach to lipids and macromolecules on membrane lipids and will induce atherosclerosis. So there is a real concern here in terms of cardiovascular toxicity, and you can again go back to Professor Agarwal's studies, and you can show that oxidative stress is indeed increased with intravenous iron in the laboratory setting. And then you get to some human studies, and again, this is from Vienna. It's another study that was looking at the increased or the change in oxidative stress across a dialysis session with a control group which was no intravenous iron versus a cohort that got intravenous iron in red. And you can see that the conclusion from this study was that indeed hemodialysis patients have high levels of oxidative stress, and this goes up across the dialysis session. Time B and C are higher than at time point A, but by D, at the end of the session, the oxidative stress is back down to normal. But interestingly, there was no difference between the group getting intravenous iron and the group getting no iron in this study. So the conclusion from this paper was hemodialysis patients are under huge oxidative stress anyway, and in this very short-term experiment across a dialysis session, there was no evidence that there was increased oxidative stress in the human setting. And then we have this data from Tilman Drucker, who we all know very well, published in Circulation. This has been widely quoted. This was a study looking at common carotid artery intimal medial thickness in relation to iron loading per year, dose of iron in milligrams per year. You can see there is indeed a correlation. That's what the red line shows. There's a correlation, and that was statistically significant. And I think in terms of statistics, you cannot argue that's a positive effect. What I think you can look at also is that the blue dots are very widely scattered, and there's an enormous variability even in this measurement. I don't think that necessarily proves that more iron causes more intimal medial thickness, but obviously that's the data that was generated from this paper that was published in Circulation a few years ago. So where do I think we are with oxidative stress? Well, I think that we have to recognize that iron can increase oxidative stress by generating free radicals in vitro setting, and this is a concern that we have to be aware of. But there is a disconnect between the iron in the laboratory settings and the oxidative stress measured in vitro studies and in the in vivo setting. And I think that it's fair to say that all intravenous iron preparations have this potential, but the evidence is that it's a transient effect at best and is lacking in clinical situations. And the final thing I want to address really is, if there really is an impact on oxidative stress, would that increase mortality in patients getting intravenous iron? So I'm going to present, to finish off, with two studies, which are observational studies published in the last few years on the risk of mortality with intravenous iron in the CKD setting. And the first one comes from Harold Feldman and his colleagues, published in the Journal of American Society of Nephrology in 2004. And this was a very large cohort study, 32,500 hemodialysis patients, as only the Americans can do, a very large sample size obtained from Fresenius Dialysis Centers. And they looked at all-cause mortality. They looked at with a two-year follow-up. And they had a very sophisticated time lag model and multivariate analysis to look at the timing of intravenous iron against the mortality and the morbidity in this study. And the data are really summarized in the next slide, which are shown here. So basically, they used albumin as a positive control. So you can see that the bottom panel with the bars in green, you can see that if patients have a low albumin, then their mortality is up to 5 times greater. And we've recognized this for a while. Hypoalbuminemia is a marker of mortality in dialysis patients, partly due to malnutrition, partly due to inflammation, or mainly inflammation, against patients who have a normal albumin concentration. And then you can look in the upper half of the graph there, the dose of iron over 6 months in this controlled cohort study. And you can see that it doesn't matter how much iron the patient has received over the 6 months, whether it's 0 to 700 milligrams or 700 to 1,000, 1,000 to 1,800 or more than 1,800 milligrams over the six-month period. There's no hint there of any increase in mortality in this very elegantly conducted time-lagged Cox regression analysis. And the other bit of data is the data from, again, Kamyar Kalantar Zadi. You can see here, this is again on the x-axis, the iron dosing in milligrams per month for all-cause mortality on the left and cardiovascular cause mortality on the right. And you can see that the lowest rate in this analysis is somewhere around the 200 to 300 milligrams of iron per month. If you go more than 400 milligrams a month, then this shoots up. And similarly, if you get no intravenous iron, then you seem to have a slightly higher mortality too. Now, this is confounded. It's obviously an observational study, so it doesn't prove causality. And one could easily argue that the ones getting more than 400 milligrams a month are sicker patients. They may be having occult GI bleeding, and that's why they need more IV iron, and that's why they die, etc. So there's huge confounding in this analysis like there is in any observational study. But what it does suggest is that certainly up to 300 or so milligrams a month, there isn't a concern in terms of increasing mortality in this observational analysis. So this is my last slide, just to conclude. I think I've shown you data that suggests that laboratory and animal studies have produced some safety concerns on intravenous iron, particularly in relation to things like enhancing bacteremia or enhancing oxidative stress. But the applicability of the laboratory data to clinical practice has shown a disconnect. And we do have a problem with that. It does not mean the laboratory data is wrong. It does mean that we're not sure whether that can be extrapolated into the clinical use of intravenous iron in chronic kidney disease patients. And there is increasing evidence showing the benefits of intravenous iron, as nicely discussed by Carlo and Angel in the two previous talks. Safety profile seems to be acceptable. The FAIR-HF study, for example, didn't show any concerns against placebo in a double-blinded fashion, but you could argue that this is not a long-term follow-up, and we do have a need for continuing research to try and answer these safety concerns. Thank you very much.